Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hello there, this is Rich Herring's Leicester Square Theatre Podcast. We've got Johnny Vegas on today, it's worth hanging around. But before that, let me just tell you, this episode of Rehearlerstapur is sponsored by Simon Love to attempt to get people to buy his debut solo LP, It Seemed Like a Good Idea at the Time, which is out via the Fortuna Pop record label on LP, CD, do they still do those? And download on the 7th of August. For some reason, LPs are released on Fridays now, he says. I don't care. The LP consists of 12 songs, mostly about love, hate and Elton John. One of the songs, The Meaning of Love, has Stuart Lee reading the Wikipedia entry of love over the top of Simon and his band, The Old Romantics, attempting to be a soul band. That makes sense, doesn't it? Because I did a show about love. So yeah, get Stuart Lee to... Yeah, I want to get Stuart Lee to do that. Just sell out, get the commercial bloke off the telly to do it, rather than the cool guy reading off a bit of email. Anyway, there's a free launch party for the record at Tamas's Dock Boat Venue Place in London on Thursday the 13th of August. I can't believe he's inviting you all to go there. I'm not sure that's true, but it's there. So there'll be some other bands playing as well too, probably. Go to that if you like free music. You can follow Simon on Twitter at Simon Love Rules. Listen to some of his songs at simonlove.bandcamp.com. Buy the LP from www.fortunapop.com. Thank you for sponsoring the episode, Simon. Your poor choice of comedy has let you down. But apart from that, you're all right. Let's watch. This is a good one. I've seen it. Johnny Vegas's Rehearlerstapur. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who has just been on eBay buying up as many Amstrad emailer phones as he could find. It's Richard Herring. Thank you very much. Hello. Hello, Leicester Square Theatre. Welcome to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast, or as some of the cool kids have started calling it, Rehearlerstapur. And been very exciting. We have I've got a giveaway to give away to the audience, as promised last week. If you remember, I talked to someone in the audience. I'm one of the early, I think maybe the first or second podcast. He was called Dan. He works for insertcoinclothing.com. He sent me some t-shirts, and he sent me, look, this is going to drive you nerds insane. Look, it's a bag, but it's got a PlayStation. It's literally got a play. Yeah. And I don't want that. I'm 47. I'm only 48 years old. So I'll give this to one of the nerds in the audience. I have to decide. I'm going to decide. None of them are wearing badges. So I'm going to decide by... Yeah, there's a man wearing a badge. Would you like that PlayStation? Would you... Not, why not? Yeah, why not? Yeah, why not? No, you can't have it. Would you wear this every day and go to work carrying it and put your... What do you... What, Can you wash it? What are you planning to do with it? It's not that exciting, is it? Bloody hell. So what do you do for a living, sir?
I'm unemployed.
You're unemployed us. Yeah. Well, you don't deserve a free bag. get a job. This is Cameron's Britain now, mate. What would you like to do if you had a job? You'd like to get some money. You have to get a job. You have to have an idea of what the job's going to be. What's your field of expertise?
English teaching.
That's a noble profession. If I give you this bag and you get a job as an English teacher, do you promise you will go into school every day wearing this with this bag? Because if you do, I think the kids will bully you. My friend Jeff Quigley had a bag that his dad worked in. I don't know, his dad must have worked in mechanics or something, but he had, we all had Adidas bags and different things, but Jeff Quigley, my friend, his bag said Snap-on tools on it. Which, he didn't get bullied much at school for that. There you go, what's your name?
Joe,
there you go, Joe. You joined in a bit in the first half, so there you go. Give a round of applause to that unemployed man. Let's catch him up. Now only the people with jobs applaud. Thank you very much, Joe. We always wondered what Adidas stood for when we were at school. You know, my friend Phil Fry thought it stood for All Day I Dream About Sex. My friend Dave Tozer, he disagreed. He said it stood for After Dinner I Did a Shit. That's what it stood for. I countered that it was actually named after the Adolf and something Das, who ran a bag manufacturing company in Germany in the 1920s. And it was a conglomeration of his and Adolf Das, and it became Adidas. I was bullied a lot at school. That's one of the things I have to try and remember. I nearly got there from memory, which is that's part of the show Headmaster Son. I'm actually doing all 12 of my one-man shows here at the Leicester Square Theatre in August and September. And I've started trying to remember the shows and relearn them and do them at gigs and stuff. It's a stupid fucking idea. This was 18 hours of material plus a new show at the end I'll be doing. I thought, I'll give myself a break from Edinburgh this year. I'll just do all of my shows and a new show. That'll be easy with a tiny baby at home. Fucking idiot. It's kind of weird as well going back looking at your old material, because some of this is from 10, 12 years ago. I've changed a lot since the oh fuck I'm 40 days. I think in the light of Operation U-Tree, I don't think I would do some of the material I did in that show. times and tastes change. I think Twitter's going to go a little bit mad if they see some of the jokes I did in those shows taken out of context. I love Twitter, you're fantastic. Anyway, let's crack on with the show. We've given away a bag. That's if you come down and see the show, you could get a bag. That is... or something else. You never know what you might get. So do come down, go to leicestersquaretheatre.com, and you can get tickets for either this show or any of my other shows. Our guest this week is... He's probably best known as Gully Sutherland from Tipping the Velvet. That's why we're all here. That's what we mainly want to talk about today. Will you please welcome, ladies and gentlemen, it's Johnny Vegas, ladies and gentlemen. Johnny Vegas. It really is. Come in. Cheers. Thank you for coming. Sit down. Make yourself at home. How are you doing?
I'm good. Good. Thank you for making that reference. Nobody ever remembers my... 10 seconds on that.
Well, it was a good. I remember Tipping the Velvet because there was some. It was about Victorian lesbians, wasn't it? Was that what the?
Well, it was, but I, it was almost like a Mike Lee go off and research your character.
Right.
I spent there was 5 fittings for me wig and my stick-on beard, and then this tweed jacket, and then they got me to sort of improvise about 20 minutes of. Vaudeville stand-up.
Oh, really?
That they never used. You know, it was just one of them on the day. You go, it's one of the toughest jobs I ever did. And I was just gone like that. And they're going, get back to the woman with the woman.
Had a big...
Like, who's bothered? Dove. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know...
Oh, sorry to bring it up again. I didn't realise how damaging...
I thought that was going to be me breaking into... You know, that was going to be my way in to serious acting. And... obviously, it wasn't.
You found your way in there since then, though. You have done a lot of serious acting.
Oh, yeah, I was amazing in The Libertine, wasn't I? Check out the accent on that. Who's going to the theatre? It's coming to something when Johnny Depp does a better English accent than you. It was woeful.
You've done Chekhov, you've done Bleak House. You've done Celebrity Juice.
Bleak
You've
House.
Done everything.
Bleak House was all right, but it was a masterclass in editing because I'd learnt it back to front, but nerves got the best of me. You know that I can name the birds. Couldn't. Watched it on the first day and went, I can name the birds. Phil. Jeff. Whoever he was, the young actor, I actually heard him whisper, he's going, this is what happens when you bring in a comedian to do an actor's job. I mean, confidence when, I remember thinking that day on the scene, if you just, when they say action, run up and jump out of that window and run off across the rooftops, it'll make a brilliant story one day. And I'll never forgive myself for not being brave enough to just leg it. Just run off from the set and go, I'm out of here, suckers. You named the fucking birds. But I didn't. I stuck around and the producer came in and helped me take my shoes off, and that's when you know you're in trouble. We're going to put some boards up after lunch. You know, and you go, really? With all the words on. I did get through it once, but this huge fucking wood pigeon... I got it right. The one time I got it right, and this huge fucking pigeon fell off the perch, and everyone had thought it had died. And the animal wrangler ran on and ruined me shot. I was so pleased with myself, and I stayed in character. And the next day I was like, well, that's not bad. Your first day was awful. The producer's coming in, helped you undress, trying to remind you of how shit you were. And tomorrow you're doing a scene with Charles Dance. Because I hate it. If you're not from an acting background, it's really... It is. Every job is... It's almost like going to a new school every day.
Yeah, yeah,
you know what I mean? Everybody knows each other.
Yeah.
You don't. You don't have the craft of, I think, confidence.
I think it's confidence acting. Well, you know, but then it's also... Once you're in the club, you're in the club as well. And it's like, you know, I think acting... People who are really good at acting are really good, but there's a lot of... It's not... There's a lot of actors that the job isn't necessarily that hard, I think, you know what I mean? But they're in... They get to the point where they think we're the most important people in this production.
Yeah, but they don't want anybody else to know that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And the last thing they want is comics coming in. Exactly. You know what I mean? They've been trained to go to rehearsals going... Or to auditions, you know, fundamental going, I'm your man.
Yeah.
Whereas I you know, I think as a comic, you turn up and you go,
But I'm sure...
I always remember Sean Lott going, I love the chat. You know, with the director. Yeah. I love the chat. And then at the point where they go, well, should we have a read? And he says, I always want to go, no. It's like a bullseye. You know, and they go, do you want to go for the... And he goes, no, I've had a cracking day. I'll just take the tankard. Thank you. And the money. And that's always made me go, let's not spoil this. We're getting on really well. I went in to read for a shrunken head on Harry Potter, and you're going, once I watch the movie, you're going, who cast me thinking I could do a Barbados accent? Where was the huge shock value that Lenny Henry stole that part from me? That, it's one of them, you know, you sit in the cinema and you go, I'm not really angry about losing out on that one. I should have got a Sam Ganji. Yeah. I didn't know they wanted, you know what I mean, a proper, oh, I don't know, Mr. I went in doing my own genuine, just me. I went and watched that. I paid for me and my brother, we went to watch it. And the worst thing was, just before it, an advert come on for PG tips. And it was pretty much there on the big screen, this is your destiny. And what made it worse was a bloke sat three seats away from us who just leant forward and stared at me in disbelief as if you couldn't be in two places at once. And his fucking eyes were burning into me as I got ready to watch what could have been just drift away into the distance.
But I think a lot of that also, that feeling comes from the insecurity within you. I think a lot of comedians are quite insecure about that. I mean, I feel the same when I go for acting auditions. I think, oh, I'm terrible, and you know, and it is a confidence thing. But I think maybe you think it's a club and they actually are all like, none of us can believe we're here, and you're all
working. I think they're more afraid than all of us. If you talk to most actors, the one thing that terrifies them is stand-up.
Yeah. Yeah,
for them, it's you know what I mean. All the classes are, it's the loneliest job in the world. It's all down to you. It's down to if you work with any actors who you know they go, "Should we ad-lib? Should we play around?" And you would think they've just said, "Should we finger your mum?" you see the look in their eyes, don't you? Of going off script. Do I look like Schumacher? It's. Which is what we'd probably enjoy a bit more, is going, let's mess around with it. But once you get the chance to do it more of it, you learn that. But I think going into it, it's never... If you get a few more jobs in, then you'll meet someone that you've worked with. You know what I mean? There's somebody to sit with.
I mean, you're an actor now, though. You're mainly... You're more an actor than a stand-up now, aren't you? Not really. When was the last time you did stand-up?
Well, people would say... Opinions on that vary. Many would say I never did. A long time. I've been going out and trying to do... it's odd that I'm sort of trying to get back into it. I'm trying to get back into it as less Johnny, more me, which is really hard because the temptation to not give in.
It's a complicated relationship you have with your on-stage character.
Yeah,
I would say even for most comedians, who all comedians are playing some kind of heightened version of themselves, sometimes playing a character, but your character is
it comes from a darker depth.
It's a darker
it?
Place, and it's sort of part of you. And I've sort of seen you discuss the fact that it's a voice in your head that you can give access to the stage and get it out. Is that fair?
I can, but I don't like to because he just if this. Again, from a confidence point of view, if I'd have drank a lot more and let Johnny come out here, we wouldn't have this table now, would we? Let's be honest, we'd be mid-lawsuit. The man with the bag would be hanging from one of the lighting things. It sounds like God, because I that was a part of me that Johnny was fearless about performing comedy. I have the utmost respect for comedy and don't find myself funny. Johnny would go, "I'll show you funny. Let's look at what you've written. That's shite. But I'm going to go out and mess around with this thing that you wrote here and we'll do 20, 30 minutes with it." Do you know what I mean? Stuff that I could never come up with on my own.
But I think that's any performer has that to some degree. I think with you, it does seem like a much more extreme transition from what the things I've read about it. But any, I can sit at home and write some material, but if I come on stage and start, letting it form itself, that is much better than the stuff I write at home. So I think any comedian has that, but perhaps not to the level they're feeling, let's chain up this other part of me.
I'm not for a second saying it's any different in the process. Because it's mad sometimes, isn't it, that you might write 10 minutes and quietly go, "I think this is the best thing I've ever written." And one heckle off something you've written takes you in a direction. And you're suddenly going, it's a killer, because what you've gone off on is better than that 10 minutes that you've really worked and crafted. And yet you're going, it took that prompt. Do you know what I mean? It's the difference of writing in your... And writing at home, writing in front of a desk, but taking it out and running it.
And there's just something about having an audience, I think, and they're just being... I just love that when you get into that. It doesn't happen every time, certainly for me anyway, but you've got that kind of... It feels like a white heat of energy, and suddenly you go bang, and the thing that you've been trying to... Even if you've been doing a show for a while, suddenly you get to a bit and you get it right all of a sudden. Yeah. Something happens and you just change it, and you change everything, and what you've been struggling to write for a day just comes out... better than you could ever have ever
remember. Because you've got that pressure of lots of people going, well, it isn't you wandering through and going, what do you think about this, and It's very hard as well when you're in a relationship, because when you show it to someone and you can just tell the way they walk off. You've not run it in. You've not... You know what I mean? I always vowed I'd never be... You know the comics that you met that would run material in as natural conversation? Yes. And you're like, fuck you. You've done a lot with your day. What, you went to visit a church and then you did this and then you did this and it's all... trying to pass it off as natural conversation. You did not do that. I know for a fact you probably spent two-thirds of it masturbating out of fear. I can't... It's weird because you can't discuss it with anyone.
No.
It's such a personal... Do you know what I mean?
A personal
thing until it gets out there.
Yeah.
And then, thankfully, the audience will be pretty honest with what's working and what's not. And it's how you adapt to it working and not working once you get out there.
Yeah, of course.
Now, me, myself, I would then start apologising profusely and create a puddle. Whereas Johnny would go, it was meant to fail. I think that was always his thing, was it was meant to fail, it wasn't meant to be... I think primarily that was, it's not meant to be funny. I'm not here to make you laugh. But was brave enough to stand up and go, I don't want to be funny.
Yeah, well, the exciting thing about watching, I saw your 1997 show, which you won the big award for in Edinburgh, I think, didn't you? Didn't you?
No, Jesus Christ, I was bitter as...
Well, you should have done. But you know, it was a terrifying show because you just didn't know. You don't know. It feels like the character on stage is out of control, which isn't often the case with a stand-up.
Oddly, that was the only year that it was. I hadn't known that thing of working a room for an hour. You know, where you had to be out on a certain point.
Yeah.
So for all the material, I went up for the first time to go, and then got right. It's got to be an hour. It's got to be this. And from gigging up north. And it's not this north versus south thing, you know, the comic, it isn't, but we had fewer clubs, and as a compere, you were sort of hired to carry the night, not do 7 minutes. It was, especially Fog and Bucket.
Yeah.
Dave wanted his money's worth, so you were probably doing an hour and a half every weekend when you went out there. So you had all this material to put in, but it had a beginning, middle and end. It had a story to it.
Yeah.
And when I was writing the book sort of ends with Johnny finally taking over, but I think that was the best moment of me writing, Johnny wanting to go out of control, but it's sticking to a storyline.
Yeah.
Within the show.
Okay, yeah.
I think beyond that, Johnny started to go, I don't need this, I don't need parameters. And then you're going, you've got 3-hour gigs that have just been awful. Because you can only say 17 times, where are you from? And then people just go, he's very opinionated on any word he wasn't born. He seems very angry. I wish he'd grown up on a small island. In the middle of nowhere with no knowledge.
And do you think to an extent
of Scarborough?
Do you think to an extent that being... Because obviously you became very successful very quickly, but then in a way success was, you know, the Johnny Vegas character sort of came from a place of failure, really, I suppose. So was success his kryptonite, really, and that makes it difficult for...
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. Even going into, I think, bigger theatres... In bigger rooms.
Yeah.
It was a big... That Johnny wanted to talk to somebody in the front row. When there's a second tier who can't hear what you're on about because he didn't even hold the mic close enough. It was an interesting thing that first time round. And interesting now, could you write a show for a bigger... It was almost like an art school experiment that continued but had to end at some point.
Yeah.
From a self-destructive point of view... But from a sort of... Johnny never wanted that success. Do you know what I mean? He never wanted to play a big room. It wasn't about that. He was playing a decent gig to a decent size. And success was... People wanted to... It's mad, this, because it's all in your own head, but you're going, he hated dumbing down to do TV.
Yeah.
When you did TV, and then we did, you do the adverts, that's the inevitable thing. You're suddenly selling tea. And it's been far more successful than you know, anticipated. And then when it comes to a gig, Johnny's going, fuck your tea. And he's going out with no shirt, shouting at people, and there's rows of people getting up going, Jemima, we're leaving. Because I think they genuinely thought they were coming to see a puppet show. And Johnny was like, you'll do that. If you want to buy yourself, you know what I mean, clothes that fit, go and do it. But I ain't doing it when it comes to the gigs. The live stuff was always sort of pretty much belonged to him. No, I didn't have a say in it, but I'm always amazed when I do these interviews. I sound like I should be sectioned. I can't even say it. Section.
It is.
Sectioned.
I think out of anyone, you know, I've talked to lots of comedians and I've talked a lot about that. You know, I do stuff where I feel I play around a little bit with mental issues. But to actually, you know, and I play myself a snooker as two different personalities, you know, and, which
it's
is
nice.
Kind of crazy.
It's nice, isn't it, when you can play with mental issues
it is.
And not be mental.
Yeah, well, one hopes so. One hopes so.
But you get to walk away from it without really alienating the people close to you.
But it's, you know, if you're talking about yourself as if you're not, as if this person isn't you at all, and that is someone who could take control of you in a different situation. So is that genuinely how it feels?
I know where you're going, though, where it's like it's almost like a cop out, and you go, it isn't a cop out. He's a person that lives within me, but he's not me. I ended up, and I do mean it, I was more like PR for him. After the gig, I did a Marie Curie fundraiser in this working man's club, and it was, everyone was dying. And Johnny walked across the tables and ended up, there was a table with people all with the same T-shirts on, and he stuck his shirt in this girl's mouth and went, drink my Guinness, and poured it down his front. After the gig, I'm sat in the dressing room and it's like I've got control of my body again, and I'm sitting there and she's like, well, I hope you're proud of yourself. That poor girl with learning difficulties has gone home in tears. They brought him out on a special trip to see this fundraiser. Johnny, in Johnny's head, they were on some kind of stag or hen do. And it got big laughs. But suddenly it was this thing of going, genuinely, it was like, you know what, we could be in a lot of trouble. Well done. And when you sat backstage as Michael Bennett's and going, I'm really sorry. And they're going, don't make out like you don't know what you just did. And you're going, it was me, but it wasn't me. He looks like me. I would never stuff any bit of my tailoring in a woman's mouth. And I certainly wouldn't relinquish Guinness for nothing. And there were genuine moments like that where you're going, I'm really sorry. In the heat of the moment, Johnny's gone, this, you know what I mean? We need someone to turn the gig around. For myself afterwards, you're obviously going, okay, I will step back from the charity for a few years and let you rebuild.
But comedy sort of needs that freedom. I think most comedians will get some kind of after show worry. You know, they'll go, oh, I said, you know, I'll say something, go, why did I say that? Why did I do this and that? And you'll feel as mortified as anyone's ever going to make you feel. But you need that freedom on the stage to be able to do.
Well, you do, but look at the social media thing now. Twitter, had things been around then? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's getting harder and harder, and it's almost like we're complaining. And there are times where you're going, there's comics apologising for things that needn't be, I don't think needn't be apologised for.
No.
But within a gig scenario, when you see it in a hard print, what's been said, taken out of context by the wrong person, but that gets picked up on. You know, John Ronson's book,
Yeah, it's great.
It's a brilliant thing. This notion of going, one wrong word, when your job is actually to go out and... You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Comics like yourself who plan.
Not tonight.
No, but they go out. To think that one foot over the mark can then...
Well, yeah,
it's recorded on media as that's what you stood for, and you're going by people who have an opinion on you who never came to a show, who never saw what you did.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Who I do. Never... I mean, Seinfeld is kind of in trouble for saying that audiences are too politically correct now because of this Twitter thing. And he's sort of wrong, but he's also sort of right, because comedy needs that freedom. You need, you know, we're in a space, even if you're recording it, even if you're putting it on TV or putting it out on the internet, wherever, it's still, you're in a space, you're in a safe space, and you're doing stuff. The minute that we, as a comedian, you start thinking, oh, I mustn't, you know, I must keep a check on myself, then you can't go and find the extraordinary, you know, comedy's going to become very bland, I think, is the problem. If everyone who gets offended by something can say, I'm offended by that.
Well, so it's gone one way of going, play to the biggest room possible for the greatest amount, you know what I mean? Of, you know, make the gigs truly pay, but then you go, but then with that, you were asking people in who don't, and it sounds like an inverted snobbery, who don't go to comedy.
Yeah.
And then you suddenly come along and there's something that, you know, they're actually used to having their comedy butchered for them.
Yeah.
By commissioners and being used to this, and then they hear something that challenges something in them and they're outraged, and the press are always continually looking for someone who's outraged by something that wasn't that outrageous. And Jesus, I pissed on the side of the... My second tour, I mean, I'd just about had enough. We'd gone a bit doolally. You know that tour, Cabin Fever?
Yeah.
And we got to Liverpool and we were in this gig, and our tour manager, who was also the driver and the opening act, Daryl Martin, went out. Because it had been a church, but it was no longer a church, but he went out and decided to give a sermon instead of his set. I went out, and there was a guy in the front row that was reviewing the gig from the Liverpool Echo. You know, and you're going, oh, are you the comedy review? And he went, no. He said, I do dog shows. Pet shows, mainly. I said, well, why are you here? And he went, well, nobody else wanted to come. So I got a woman to take her belt off and walk me around like a dog. And we recreated Crofts. But then eventually I went, oh, he could be in trouble. And I swear to God, I squeezed out that much poo. Just that much. But I did the quivering legs perfectly. You know, of a dog that's... And it all kicks off. You remember Jax, my technician, the lad with the Mohican?
Yes, yeah.
We had to make out that it was a prop. So I was telling him it was Nutella. And then I asked Jax to clean it up, and Jax went, no. And I'll never forget the tour manager rang us and he went, the thing is, Johnny, the show's good enough without it. And I went, I'm not going to shit on stage every night. I might have reminded you at the moment, Macbeth is touring and Jane Oryx is pissing in a helmet. But they sent someone who reviewed a pet show to review the gig on in that white heat. I found that really offensive.
Yeah.
But the next day on the front of the paper, it was, there was a time a comedian could make you smile, you know what I mean? Yeah. With a wink or a nod of the hat. That all ended last night. But at the time I was passionate that we'd done the right thing.
It's very committed. It's very committing to the role. That is.
Well, it's either I dress as a giant cockatiel and ride a bike. Do you know what I mean? And just hope they can't tell the difference between human and miniature. Human and miniature. That was an odd statement, wasn't it? I'm just opening up to you. These are my honest thoughts on stand-up. It is being, you know, there's a moment where you go, I suppose I only tell that story because at that time, and the reaction to that gig was, some people said that was the best thing I've ever seen.
Coprophiles.
Two people got in touch and said I was sick in my handbag. But nobody will forget that night in Liverpool. And it wasn't that I sat backstage and went, oh, you know what, I don't think this material's strong enough, I'm going to have a shit. I didn't. I went out, it had been a tough tour. We had... we thought it was tough. We ended up in Scotland and Karen Curran went off on holiday and didn't send any posters out.
Right.
We did the gig up there. I had to... It was easier. There was that few people in Edinburgh... I had to give out balloons and get people to create audience members and give them a personality. And I went round and interviewed balloons with faces drawn on them.
That's
the
a good
next
idea.
Gig, I ended up working behind the bar and just serving them because it was so awkward, the size of the room. And then we went to Sky and nobody took... There was eight people and two of them we'd invited... Because he'd been on the road with her. We bumped into him at a cafe on the way up there. And the promoter did a runner and left the keys with this woman. And she said, I haven't got keys for the bar. All I can do is I can put a kettle on. And we were being quite arrogant, you know, going, love, any minute now there's going to be 800 people in here. And when eight turned up, she went, well, I'll put that kettle on. We ended up taking them just for a drink. You know, we said, look, can we cancel the gig? And we'll just take you for a pint instead. Would that be... So we took eight people out and we went on the... We'd just come back from Poland and we had cheap cigars. We gave them all cigars and we went for drinks with them. And we were going back to the hotel and there was a wheelie bin with a poster for the gig on it. And I'll never forget Daryl going... If only the bins had gone out yesterday. We'd have sold out. So it was a tough tour.
You can come to the toilet and watch me shit. All eight of you can stand in the cubicle with me. It'll be fine.
Let's do Macbeth. He wants to piss in my hat.
Well, it's very. I think, you know. I think the thing is, I think often you kind of have that character, but you are very funny as you, as Michael Pennington. You are. I mean, you're being you now. You're not being Johnny now, and you're being very funny. So I think it's feeling that. You know, it's just letting that go and trusting that you'll still be funny. It's just a different thing.
Yeah, it's hard.
Because I think it's a difficult thing to carry on that character forever would be difficult on your mental and physical health anyway. I think you've sort of said you feel happy in your life now and so it's kind of difficult to access that. Is that true?
I am, yeah. I'm content. Yeah. It's an odd... I think it's an odd thing to get your head round.
Yeah.
I think from... It's a brilliant job discovering stand-up at a certain stage. If you feel like you've not achieved what people expected or your outlook on the world is jarring with where you've grown up or what you've done, where you're questioning too much. But it does become that It wants everything from you. And there was a certain stage where you go, you're either a martyr to it, or you learn from it, and you meet other people through it, and you get the opportunity to do other things.
Yeah.
And you meet someone, do you know what I mean? Personally, you develop, and then you sort of kind of go, it was great, but don't cling on to it.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I see a lot of comedians who are very successful, and you see them and you kind of think they're not happy. Their success hasn't made them happy. They thought that by getting this, that, you know, and I think maybe I thought, oh, maybe if I become a really successful comedian, I'll be really happy. But actually, I think, you know, I don't think I would have been if that had ever happened. It'd be nice to have the fucking opportunity to find out. But, you know, I think you sort of see, you know, I went to this Seinfeld gig years ago and I got invited to the after show party, which never happens to me because it was just coincidentally. And it was a lot of, you know, the A grade UK comics, and they were all in there, and I was saying, oh, this is great. And, you know, backstage, you might meet Seinfeld, this is really cool. And all the rest of them were like looking around, and you could see them looking at me going, why has Herring been invited here? What's that? There's been a shift in the dynamic. Is he now coming up? Am I going down? So everyone's terrified of losing their position. They're all kind of complaining about looking miserable.
There is, but you've always had you write plays, you write everything, you know what I mean? You will go off and you proved yourself as a comic. You were somebody I watched on TV growing up. It was part of, I was quoting today the School for the Hard Knocks, which is still my favourite. No, it was, you know what I mean? I'm not. It isn't that. It's that thing of going, you either... it's almost like... it sounds really snooty, but it's an education background, and whether it's an Oxford background or whether it's an art school background, I think you move with... You are always wanting to create something. And the fame bit of where it goes is something that you don't actually have a say in.
No. Well, and as
the
you
most
say,
ironic thing is, like I said, getting known for a bunch of adverts.
Yeah, well, that's interesting that you see that as... I mean, you know, there's obviously a choice. You can choose not to do the adverts. So the adverts came out of a charity thing to begin with, didn't they? So they were that character was...
Well, no, they were sold to a charity.
Right, yeah.
Because
that's the other way around.
Because the ITV box was shite, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah.
It didn't work. Loads of people were sort of, you know, meeting us in the street and going,
yeah,
you know, I've got the monkey, but the fuck, I can't get reception. And when it went under, you can't know, when ITV Digital went under, you can't know how relieved I was when I opened the paper and they had the monkey in a noose and not me. Which was basically the Football Association. They set up a ridiculous deal that wasn't financially viable. And they sent a bloke in there that had nothing to do with finance. You know what I mean? But
yeah.
Suddenly, I think they worked out that what they were paying for the, you know, First Division... Because I'm more rugby league, I'm not so much football. But the First Division matches, for what they were paying for the rights, it was cheaper to put everyone in a cab or a limo in certain areas and take them to the game and pay for the rent. So how they ever thought they were going to, you know, make this money back?
If only they thought, just let's make these monkey puppets and sell these off the back of these adverts, they'd be millionaires.
I was filming Blackball and I met a bloke in Torquay and he went, I've got a word house full. Now, here's the thing. You, on the seafront, in a big settee with him, just signing him and giving them away for a day. And that was when they were still a bit of me going, I used to be cutting edge. I was once the critic's choice. And he went, oh, I'll give you 5% off the top. But I think he had that. He owned that many monkeys after they were skint. It was. It would have took 3 days to make enough to cover me lunches. But you redefine that, aren't you? But you don't, and you move through it, and it's a funny thing with the fame aspect of being good at what you do, because the majority of the public judge you by where they've seen you. You know, they think you've not been working if you've not been on TV, and you're going, I've been doing a wonderful project for the Manchester International Festival. And there's my dad's mates just walk off and go, fuck.
But
really? Oh, you're a director now, are you?
But it gives you the freedom to, I think, to take... It's interesting where people go. I think it's interesting to see where people go with their success and what they choose to do with it. And, you know, I think, like, some people who start to think, oh, they are kind of comedians, and then they're just... I was going to choose something that was so obvious who I was talking about there that I think I might just change tack. that they, I don't know, sit on the panel of some talent show judging contest or something. Something. The sort of thing, well, where are you going with you know, because either you've got the freedom to do whatever you want to do when you're successful. So you can say, I want to do this play or I want to do this esoteric idea, and then maybe I'll do an advert to cover something else. But
don't get me wrong, I miss the ads. Yeah. You know, I even, my opening thing now when I'm trying to do stand-up is, I've been dumped by a puppet. How fucking depressing is that? I think, you know what I mean? I'm no longer doing those ads, and those ads funded my passion project.
Yes.
That basically paid for me for half a year to go off and go, well, sure. I want to do this, and I want to do a piece of theatre, I want to be braver. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I want to be bolder, but I'm a divorced man. And I have two separate financial outgoings. I can't be. It's really hard trying to claw back. On the period I was working on the book, I did two or three directing projects, and you're going, I absolutely know now that's what I want to do.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I would love to do more of that. It's the one thing is Michael. And I know I've said it before, but as Michael, I feel as confident as I did as Johnny doing stand-up.
Yeah.
And yet an odd bit of me is drawn back to the stand-up now. Yeah, I'm looking at this and I want to do that, but I'm also practically having to pay bills. And if you whinge about paying bills in the public eye, there's nothing more annoying when somebody's going out and doing a proper job. You know, and you're going, I'm really struggling right now. I'm torn between the writer within and the man who's getting money for fucking old Rob. But I'm as you can't whinge about your income if you're living in Richmond. Fundamentally. Nobody's bothered about the personal reasons of why you went to Richmond. You're going, well, I have a son from a previous marriage and we wanted to be closer to him. And people are going, Richmond. I imagine your child punts to school. So you've got to be practical. You've got to bear in mind that you... But the stuff I'm longing to do... You know what I mean? Yeah. I've always knocked back those shows. Every year I'm a celebrity. Every single year. And for me, it's a sign that they think I'm at a point where I need.
Yeah. It is quite insulting for them to ask you, I think.
I don't think they see it as insulting, and that's what's really insulting. And I keep telling them, if I come on here, I'll eat all the rice in one night. And fucking terrorise them. And I'll nick their T-shirt when it comes to voting. I'll wear someone else's T-shirt. It would be Lord of the Flies.
Yeah.
It would only be worth going in if you were going to have a genuine breakdown, not whinging because it's a bit hot. Go in there and threaten someone with a broken twig. The other way, if one of them was walking along and just an Ewok style log came swinging down and took them out, and you're going, that's because you were rude about the way I washed the dishes.
If you could actually,
if you're going to go in there, let Johnny loose in there.
Yeah. If you could actually take them hostage so they have to show it, I think that would be. I've got someone hostage, you have to keep filming this. And now I'm in control. No authorities in here.
Johnny, will you come to the cabin for the chat? And you go, no, I refuse to talk to you unless you film me whilst masturbating. Because I've gone wild.
I think it would do very
well. Well, he said. And then that really upset me because, you know what? And I know he smuggled herbs in. Go in one of them boxes and just eat the insects. Or lie back and cry all of me. Why not take all of me? Let the bugs crawl in and out of you.
Oh, my God. So
I've got a natural odour where the bugs might just scatter. You only go, it was the easiest challenge ever. Look at them. Even the earwigs detest it.
Right, I've got some questions from someone at home. First of all, I should have said this, Caroline... Don't know how you pronounce that. Qui. Qui. Oh, she's in. Hello, Caroline.
Caroline, don't sound so outraged. It's not an easy one to get.
Why don't you know how to pronounce it? You say, Rich, I choose time-travelling finger. This isn't what you were meant to do. You were meant to give me something to say, not ask me a question, but we'll ask Johnny as well. How can the most pain be inflicted on the fucking idiot of your choosing with it? So she wants to know, Caroline wants to know what I would do. I do a thing about a time-travelling finger. You can think about this as well. I don't know if I would use it for evil. If I was going to do it, I would go back and gouge out Keith Allen's eyes just as he was about to sabotage the Oxford Review in 1988, which is... And then he probably would still... I mean, it would give him more cause to sabotage the show, at least, but he'd probably be angry. If your finger could travel through time, would you... And you could attack someone with your finger, what would you...
I wouldn't attack. I'd put it in the back of JFK's head and go... It's not looking good. I'd run up like the others, looking like I was protecting him, but I would pull it out and just go, it's not, it's fucking... I was in his inner cortex, so cerebral, whatever. What is the inner brain? What's that called?
It's a good question. I've had my brain scanned. I should know about that. Is any of you nerds know what the inner part of the brain's called? Cerebellum?
Yeah, I've got it. I'll be going, that's definite cerebellum.
That man said cerebellum in such a superior way.
Or cerebellum. Whoever it was on the grassy knoll, just I'd wet it and put it in his ear and go off.
You could nudge.
No,
you
isn't
could,
it?
You could tap him on the shoulder so he goes like that and it misses. That's what you could have done. Not, oh, I'll dip in his brain, have a little Dorito with it.
Well, only because you're all going, do you reckon he's still all right?
You could have saved him.
Look, shot in the head, your head will fall forward the same way that you suddenly realise I've been sleeping with loads of women on the side and I'm going to get caught. When he fell onto Jackie's shoulder, she probably thought he was ready to confess. Fuck the American tour up, ain't it? Or, no, why, it shouldn't be JFK. Why we're stuck on these? I would... Because I was sat in the back watching it. It was brilliant watching me going, a time-travelling finger. You can do anything, and all you start thinking about is revenge. Or poking fun. I would go back and point at my parents when they went into the Christian Planning Centre. And adopted the rhythm method for me. Because I genuinely think the way they conceived has left me with about 20% less of the brain capacity that I should have had. I would point them to a chemist. I would rather come from a broken condom. Than a Pope telling me dad that if he did it slower at a certain date.
I have another question.
The rhythm method was a disaster.
It wasn't a good idea, I have to say. Another question. This is quite a niche question. We might need to explain a bit about this. You were involved in Club Zarathustra. Very early on.
I was.
And so, did you do the actual shows as well as you did the TV version, or did you do the live shows as well?
No, it was brilliant. I came down and did the live show, and I had been, as a genuine sort of starving comic, I used to, you know, when you come to London, you go, you do an open spot, and you go somewhere, and you go, so it's the three of you. Doing performance poetry to each other.
Yeah.
When you turn up at a gig and they go, do you want to help put the candles out? And you realise, I'll never forget Belushi's up in not Oxford Circus. By the way, yeah, I came down and watched it, and had I not been performing that night, I'd have been blown away. But you know, when you're going, someone somewhere has made a huge mistake. This is not the gig for Johnny. But I went on and did it. And afterwards, Stuart approached us and went, look, you know, this is a very, it's a creative thing and what we're doing, and we, none of us take any money from it. And I remember going, I'm going to have to take the money. Anyway, what we tend to do is put it back in so we can nurture it. I'm going to have to take the money. And I did. I took, I think it was either 40 or 60 quid off him. And I went, I was living on pilchards and beans.
I should explain.
And I was off. But it was on me going, God, it was brilliant. But the fear, you know what? I love watching now comedy when I'm not part of it.
Yeah.
But and yet there's nothing of going to a festival that if you're not performing, you know what I mean? I feel like I'm cheated. I've cheated my way in. But a gig like that, you don't need to be on the bill. You need to just sit back and be able to appreciate it.
Yeah, it was an amazing thing. It was Simon Munnery, I suppose, his brainchild, who did League Against Tedium and Alan Partridge. Alan Parker, sorry. I did Alan Partridge. Stuart Lee, I think, was in it. He was a minor part in it. And people like Sally Phillips and Richard Thomas. So like Jerry Springer, the opera kind of formed out of that. They did a brilliant TV version of Club Zarathustra. It was very esoteric and weird comedy, and you know, and it was a brilliant pilot they did.
I got hammered in the pilot. They gave us a bottle of whiskey. There's a guy who'd been reporting the news for 24 hours. And they were trying to shoot a piece in the park, and they were like, you can rest for a bit. And some kids came up and just wouldn't quit sort of haranguing them. And I went over and, you know, did the kind of shake your fist, angry. And he went, I'm going to go and get my dad. I went, go and get your fucking dad. I'll fight all of them because I never drink whiskey. And then the dad turned up and you're going, get everything in the truck. We're going. He was preaching in the park as Lenin. It was. But that was. There was days going out filming stuff like that. Wasn't it? You know what I mean? It was a fantastic. There were brilliant premises. Where I think they took a lot more risks.
Yeah,
with comics coming through in terms of, and you never want to sound like it was better nowadays. But you're going, Jesus, we did Johnny Vegas TV show and we shot 70 hours before I came up with a storyline.
Yeah,
and with that, and again, that was really well executed. But you're going. They turn up at live events, they see people being creative, they want a part of it, but they don't know what they want a part of. And then when you go and make something, they don't know how to market it. Mm. And it's a killer when you pull something into it and you're going, this is, it's not going to rate against certain shows, but it isn't that one day this will build an audience and your next generation will be watching these in the same way that they're watching your biggest acts now.
Yeah.
But they've never got the commitment beyond. They either want it so nobody else can have it. You know what I mean? Or they watch it in a gig where everybody else is laughing, and then when they're watching it in an edit suite and they haven't got people to confirm whether it's funny or not,
yeah,
they panic.
Well, I mean, Club Z didn't get made, which is a terrible tragedy. I mean, I suppose it is when they let people get on with it, which they did in the 90s, I think. You know, you get Vic and Bob, you get Armando Iannucci and all that gang of people coming through, you get you coming through, so you get all these, you know, and then since then it has really been like, let's put a team of people together and get some writers in and write the sketches. And actually, the way to get the interesting stuff, I think, is to just say, there's some money now. You know, Monty Python is a case in point. They just said, yeah, go off and make whatever you want and come back in 8 weeks and let us show us what you've got.
BBC Three was brilliant when it started. BBC Three was really experimental.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it was this thing of going, let's put some EastEnders in there and let's do that. You know what I mean? Yeah. Stuart Murphy left and you're going, suddenly it was this thing of, and it's always, it's this ongoing idea of, we're aiming at 16 to 23 year olds, and they won't watch anyone unless they're 16 to 23.
Yeah.
And you go, it's absolute it's nonsense, but they're afraid of going. If you sit down with certain people on TV and have a conversation with them, they're constantly asking you, and they're the ones in charge.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like a teacher that's come up against a hyper intelligent child. And they're going, what would you do?
Well, Ollie Bennett wants
but
to
I'm
ask
not
you.
But I'm not going to fucking do myself out of tea. You know that? I'm already banned from all theatres in the country after this chat.
Ollie Bennett is going to ask you this, and you know we can move on. He's paid to ask it, so let's ask it. Out of everyone in Club Zarathustra, who would you snog, marry, avoid, and kill?
What, out of the entire...
Out of all the people who are in Club Zarathustra, can you remember anyone else who's in it? Who would you snog, who would you marry, who would you avoid, and who would you kill?
I would. Is it too obvious? I'd snog Stuart.
It is too obvious. He had Sally Phillips there, all lined up, and you went for Stuart Lee.
It's not fair on Sally. Me avoiding Sally would freak her out.
It's the young Stuart Lee, so it would be quite nice to kiss him.
Yeah. No, I'd marry you.
You'd marry me?
Yeah, just to fucking make your life hell. The eggs would never be right. Every morning. I'd come up with a style of egg that you just hadn't cooked. After coming up with 19 styles of eggs, and you come down and you go, what's wrong with pushing it against the fucking wall and putting an air dryer on it? You just don't get me. And then I'd take you back to bed for angry sex.
Sounds right. And you've got to kill someone as well. Is there anyone you'd like to kill?
That fucking pianist.
Richard Thomas, the creator of Jerry Springer
Opera. Richard Thomas, you know what, I think with any musician, you know deep down it's because you never practiced yourself. But and as time goes on, you just, whenever you look at anyone who's musically gifted, you go, they had all the opportunities I never had. It's the ultimate sort of inverted snobbery. I blame them as if they came home every night and the entire family went, let's play piano, let's play together. Let's show them kids from St. Helens. I would often come home with maracas and my father would beat me with them. Trying to introduce some rhythm into the family. But they wouldn't have it. They were just focused on the talkie box in the corner, the radio. So, yeah, that's my answer. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about St. Helens a bit. You had some interesting jobs in St. Helens before you became a comedian, or before you went to university and did you studied ceramics. Or maybe after
Look at me like that. Yeah. It was a proper degree.
It's a very posh degree, I think. So it would be ceramics.
It would be now, because who'd pay $9,000 a year?
Yes.
To learn how to build a jug. You'd really have to come from a fortuitous background studying ceramics now. Hi, I'm from St. Helens. Don't worry, I'll get the money. Just give us a go on your wheel. Come on, I'll prove myself. We'll do a fundraiser in the student union.
You got a third from Middlesex University?
Yeah, I did, and I felt bad about it until I read a Marie Claire piece, and it said that if you got a third, you really parted and had all the potential to get a first, but just poured your heart and soul into being sociable. I got a third because the head of the year, I turned up on the disastrous grading day, and first of all, I brought my work and put it in. It was abstract female forms that were extruded, but then I was playing with this whole idea of manufactured beauty, and fashion magazines. And by dropping them and bending them, it was this whole idea that imperfection was beauty and that manufactured beauty in itself didn't exist. I read a lot of Naomi Wolf in a desperate attempt to get laid. And but when I turned up and put them on the floor, the head of year said, it looks really urban. So I left them in bundles on the floor. And on the day of grading, I overslept when I was putting my portfolio together and was late for the start of grading and rang a friend with the car, and the car ran out of petrol and it almost became the doom, 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 you know, the car runs out when you're legging it. Put it in there, and I got a third, but then I heard one of them whispering, going, he hasn't even bothered to paint any plants. I would have put them on plinths. I had painted plinths ready, but the head of the year told me to go with the urban look.
Oh.
And I'll never forgive him for that. And it really angered me, coming out with it. I thought I was I love art school. It teaches, do you know what I mean? It's that investing in an original idea. Invest in yourself. Believe in yourself. There's no point doing something if it's been done before you. Yes, everything's borrowed a little bit and you'll realise that there's influences, but overall, fucking go out with the third, knowing that it came from up here, then go out trying to be a poor imitation of anybody else. That was my head of year though.
It sounds good. They sound good, those figures.
It would have sounded better if I'd got a first.
I'd have given it a 2-2, definitely.
What did you get?
I got a 2-1.
Now, you see, Maddie Clare said that was someone who wanted it too much.
Well, I did absolutely no work.
Well, then fuck you.
I can't believe I got a 2-1.
I was up against... There was a girl in my year who got a first, and all she did was with bin bags build a tunnel and call it fucking travelling through time. I didn't even take a finger through it. Fucking Japanese girl. She came up to me in the canteen one day. Right, I blew my money in the first. They gave me a chequebook. I went mad and I bought a fucking poncho in Camden. I wasn't ready for that kind of wealth. I ended up having to work in the canteen, washing dishes. And one day, I'm collecting the blazers, and she went, hey, Michael, I think I love you. And I went, you know that bit where you go, it's all been worth it, you got this back. I went, really? And she went, no! Ha! I'm a lesbian! And I went home that day and I bought the cheapest fucking red wine I have ever drank. It burnt me gums as I was drinking it. College was a happy time. I did. I couldn't. Why? I don't know if she even knew my name. I wasn't a big fan of her work. And yet the worst thing is, when people went home, I did walk through the tunnel and go, what if I can go back and stop myself having my first chip? And I went through a fucking time tunnel and I came out and I was still obese and it was still 1993. Anyway, moving on.
Let's move on. I'm kind of interested in the jobs people did before they became a comedian or a performance artist or a dog shitting on a stage. You worked in an Argos warehouse?
I worked in the Argos store.
Oh, did you? Yeah.
Did everything.
Yeah.
I worked upstairs for the first 2 years. They didn't really want me on the shop floor. I didn't want to wear the uniform because it was that really... It was like a shitty brown colour. Boots had gone with grey and pink and yellow. The lemon yellow.
Yeah.
The 80s colours. And we were sadly trailing. And it was we felt a bit lawless up in the stock room. But then they eventually brought us down and allowed me to do some shop floor work. And they put me on the... They used to have the, you know, the computers at the front where you order.
Yeah.
But everything was hyphenated, and I had... I stared, this woman just came in, I read it quickly, I went, horse hair duvet. And she went, I beg your pardon, I went, horse hair duvet. And then the manager had to come over, and it was an hors d'oeuvre set. They put me on the Elizabeth Duke counter at Christmas, but it was just drunk blokes flirting, you know, going, I look better on you. They were meant to be buying a last-minute gift for the wife. They basically moved out of the Stockton because I started getting nosebleeds. It was like fucking Bukowski's post office. I started bleeding on the stock, and it kept getting sent back up because people were going, this is a gift. But there was loads of dust up there, and it was getting in me. And if I'm really honest, the days I was very, very hungover, I would just, I would hide and masturbate. And I felt like I was sticking it to the man. But there was at one point, they had put me on side for middle management. They did have their eye on me. And they were very upset when I shunned them for ceramics.
Was that before college or was that after college? Was that after college?
No, it was a build-up to college.
It was a build-up to college.
No, I finished college and went to Argos. As a trained ceramicist, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
as a ceramicist, I went, oh, where do I go now? Argos. Because I just love retail.
I assume once you've got a third in ceramics, you know, there's not many places to go. Argos is the only place it's going to take you.
All them out-of-town shots were being made.
And you pack bottles of...
TK Maxx was just burgeoning. They were looking out. They were headhunting for people like me. You really? You worked in Argos, yeah, and you've got a degree? Yeah, it's pottery. It doesn't matter. Come on.
Is it true? There's something on Wikipedia that needs a citation.
Okay.
Did you design the Old Spice bottle?
I did, but it wasn't quite what they were asking for. I tried to do something very trendy in ceramic that was a pill, because at the time, you know, everybody else was raving. So it was going to be a little one that you could break open and put on you. And they rejected that, so I built this fucking huge bottle with a fist in the top. And it basically said domestic violence. And there was promises of a campaign that could follow on if they liked the bottle, but the bottle was taken away and their number was blocked from my phone. But it was just a bit, if you go one way or the other, if you're going to chase the youth, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just, really, what kids? We'd all bought it at a school fair, hadn't we?
Yeah.
In a box with talc. Unless you were lucky enough to have a mother whose tit could produce talc. It's weird things like that where suddenly everybody wants a part of it and they go, well, you do pottery, you should design this. And you go, surely some... But you really work hard at it and they reject an idea going, no, that's too close to drugs and it's too close. And you go, well, then what... What do you honestly think is going to get any 18-year-old wearing Old Spice other than a dad collapsing on top of him from a heart attack? That is the only way that at a funeral, just fucking going, I put it on and I can remember dad just leaning against me going, there's money under the mattress. Remember me as a sturdier young man than what I am now. But yes, I did build a bottle for Old Spice.
We can use this podcast to get that citation sorted out. And is there, in the V&A, is there a collection of your ceramics at the V&A Museum?
There's not a collection. There is a single teapot.
Right.
A 1-minute teapot that I built. I did a lovely film with Roger Lowe.
Oh, yes.
Early on. Spitting Image Roger. And, yeah, it was a mad day's film. We nicked the film stock from Channel 4. Honestly, it was so low budget, but for the Arts Council. I played three different characters that were potters. And Roger put it all together, and we shot this film. The best thing was we it was premiered in Amsterdam. And we went over there for the Millennium Meeting of Potters. We all went out for a bit of a drink and a bit of a smoke, and we missed the premiere. And instead we opted to go to this sex show, which was the most disastrous and yet unintentionally comical thing I've ever seen. There was a man dressed as Batman who couldn't keep time with the rotary bed, and his penis kept coming out of her mouth, and he kept running ahead, and it looked like Hooker Duck at the fur. And then the woman who came on afterwards couldn't find the start of the Flags of the World, so she had them stop the music in the bed, and we had to sit there through 10 minutes of what I can only call vaginal rummaging. Which, and it's not very encouraging when you've got three people at the back just howling with laughter. God damn it, she's a professional. And then by the time she found it and gave the okay signal, we'd already listed the flags that we were anticipating seeing. And we left, yes, yeah, so we missed the premiere. But they asked us to do a gig there. And when you... Obviously, I used to do... this was the, when I started out, I did ceramics as part of the show. And it was live pottery, and I did it. The first gig in Manchester where Dave asked me to do a one-man show, I went out, and I was on the side going, I haven't got a 1 hour. But that's what I love about Dave Perkins. He wasn't bothered. You know, it was that thing of just do a night and just get me. There's very few other places that would give you
that
kind of freedom to go, come out and riff or mess about for an entire evening. Yeah. You've got the night all to yourself. And I packed this little kick wheel in the car at the last minute. And it was the maddest thing that when you're doing the gig and everyone's, you know, there's heckling and there's loads of fun and distraction. But then sat down to make this piece on the wheel. And folk were just mesmerised by it. They were, even the worst, the leaviest drunks were just sort of... fuck it, it's coming up from nowhere. And it was one of those accidental moments that became part of the show, you know what I mean, that moved on to things. But for me, they asked us to do a gig. That's fine for an audience, but this Millennium of Potters meeting was the world's finest ceramicist. So you go out and you throw a pot in front of them and all you can hear is, oh, shit, that. Okay, he got a third. So they... But I came up with this thing that we actually used to do for kicks, which was a one-minute teapot challenge. And they all got up, but they couldn't let go enough, and none of them could make it. And I made one. And the Victoria and Albert Museum asked if they could bring it back and fire it and put it in as part of... And I've got to say, for someone who left with a third, it was the biggest. I had so many tutors, you know what I mean, that would die to be in there. Yeah. And you're just going, ah, fuck it. I come in by the back door, but I'm in! I'm in, suckers! So, yes, I do have a teapot in there, but it looks horrendous. It is made in under a minute. There's no... But I don't know. It was nice for a while. It was like making pottery a little bit rock and roll.
It was an amazing thing. I think because it's a juxtaposition, because it's the gentleness and the art required to make, so even whatever you're making on stage, just to be doing that, and this gentle creation of something along with this character that's basically wild and insane, and then there's this little focus. It's a really, you know, if that's an accidental thing of chance that you came across that by just going, oh, I'll chuck this in the car and...
it was accidental, but it was like... Before then, the set had been going out and going, I did Potter.
Yeah.
We'd get a laugh, which would incense Johnny going, no, I did Potter. You know what I mean? Yeah. How dare you? And you from Textiles, you never wanted to look at us, and now you're all over us. And it had an odd effect that this raging about having done ceramics, that people took as... I've always said, look, there's brilliant people like White House. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Ali Parsons, these creations that you go... They're fantastic, but they walk away from him. I never got to walk away from Johnny, and there was always that mixture, but really passionately raging about being let down by ceramics. But then suddenly getting on the wheel and being able to do it, it lent it an authenticity.
Yeah.
Even if it was accidental, that suddenly people believed he'd been a Butlin's Red Coat. When there's no fucking way he could have been a Butlin's Red Coat in the 70s, even though he had a perm. You know, you're going, well, that would have made him five. But then the rumour spread of, no, he is a Potter, and he's this, and it's that, and it lent it this bizarre kind of authenticity, which it was based on authenticity, you know what I mean? Yeah. I'd done a degree, I felt that. Johnny was very angry about the degree result, but... He took what was... I always like to think within a gig, and especially the early gigs like that, it was very in your face. It was very, this guy's angry. But then there was other dimensions to Johnny, and it wasn't just a caricature. And I think the wheel was really important in going, now we're going to slow it down and go, you know what he is? He's just a bloke who wants to be loved.
Well, it's very,
at
the
end of it, there was a tenderness to it.
Yeah, but that's what you have. I mean, you have that anyway. You have that without any of the other stuff as well. There's a vulnerability to you. It's very. There's an honesty to it, even if it's exaggerated, the character. But it's, you know, you're very vulnerable. So that's what was, you know, the audience loved you, however angry you were. If you're just an angry guy who's railing against everything, that's not necessarily, it could be entertaining, but it might not be. But if the audience love you as well as, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But Johnny wouldn't know that they loved him as well, I guess. I don't know.
No, I don't think he ever got it. But it was. But at the end, at the end of a gig by the sing-along, it was that thing of, I can't admit it, but I need you.
Yeah. Well, you know, which is,
I need you, and he was always quite forthright about saying to critics what he thought of critics.
Yeah.
But for the man who came out at the start going, fundamentally, don't look at me, and don't laugh at me because it's not funny. By the end, was going, I. It was mad. It was. God, we could talk for hours. the stuff with the book of going. I have a wonderful relationship with my dad. Was Johnny had created this monster of a father, but when I went back and was looking at the book, this is when I realised that Johnny had been around a lot longer than I didn't just create him for the stage.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I didn't create him for stand up. He'd been storing problems for a long, long time and processing them and processing them in a way that he was going to use them.
Yeah.
For either comedy or for revenge or for... And with my dad, I don't think, from going to seminary when I was younger, I don't think Johnny ever forgave my dad for sending me to seminary.
Yeah, well, that's...
Even though he didn't send me. Right. He asked me if I wanted to go. But Johnny, like all perfect drunks, finds a way of blaming someone else for your mistakes.
Yeah. That's a difficult Johnny choice did. To put on a... You were 11 when you went to he did, train to be a priest?
He did, but he only asked me if I wanted to go. He never said that you're going.
No.
But I don't think he should have asked me to go because nobody could anticipate what was waiting once. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
None of it. I don't think my dad could conceive for a second what horrors might await. But years later, Johnny was going out and going, I won't forgive him for that.
Yeah.
I do. I love my dad to bits.
Yeah. But
Johnny is...
It's all about the duality of it. You know, everyone's got that. Everyone's got, my parents are just unbelievably great parents, but I'll still go back to the time, you know, my mum would be overprotective of me, which is a nice thing to be. But, you know, I was on a barge trip with her and I tried to jump to shore and she grabbed me because she was scared. But then by grabbing me, I fell, and my leg fell down the side of the barge and got crushed, you know, I was fine. But I keep going back to that, you know, and that's my mum protecting me.
Yeah.
So you still have those... resentments in there, and it's kind of, I mean, that's the interesting thing about being a comedian, that you can get to air those and for yourself, so it's kind of therapy for...
I think all stand-up is therapy in a way.
Yeah. And just so do you feel...
I've always said it's the arena of the unwell. If you are, you know what I mean? It's odd seeing people who come into stand-up, and I'm not judging. If you can come into it with a no, you know what I mean? With an intact emotional self, then all power to you. But I think all the best people I've seen have been questioning life or themselves or things deep down, you know what I mean? And airing the grievances in front of people for some very perverse reason of finding solace in front of an audience rather than talking to someone whilst lying on a couch, which would be the normal approach.
But then if you are, you know, but if that therapy has almost got to the point where you've kind of killing off Johnny Vegas and becoming Michael, my show this year is about happiness and whether being happy means you can't be funny anymore. Mm. And, you know, there's that kind of fear as a comedian, isn't it? If you're more settled down and there's nothing to rub against, that maybe you'll become...
Definitely. But there's no room in a family life for Johnny. So it'll be an interest. You know, it'll either work or it won't.
Yeah.
But I've been sort of playing with this idea of having Johnny in a suitcase. I did it, literally at one point took the clothes off, put it in a case and put it in the loft.
Yeah.
And it was that thing of, he's gone, we're done. But then I find myself in social situations as Michael, we go, I want the case back, just for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Just to deal with this prick at the garage, I want... I want Johnny back. It's a bit like, it's Breaking Bad. You know what I mean? I want the furthest... I want that say my name moment in the days that I can't do, especially dealing with teachers. But he was of his time and he did what he did. And if I want to go back, it's not... I'm interested in playing with the thing of what would happen if you let him out again.
Yeah.
But I'm... The weirdest thing is now, I'm dealing to learn with being content, which is a really strange... I always thought I'd been happy in other ways. You know, it's not been a life of misery, but I'm content now, and I like being content, and I would love... to see if I could go back and walk on the stage without a drink and drive to a gig and drive back would be a phenomenal. You know what I mean? Win for me. That would be a big moment. But that will take a lot more work. And the temptation is always easier to just have 9 pints and try and access the angry side of you.
Yeah.
But I'm not angry at people anymore. I'm not as Michael. Life's quite good. And I don't want to become that comic who fucking talks about being a dad as if they're the ones who invented it. You know what I mean? I I found it creeping in when I've been on stage going by. I've got this lovely story, but you're going, there's comics come through now who will hate me, and it's their job to hate me. I acknowledge that.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? They'll either see us as a sellout, or they'll see us as... That's their thing.
I'm not sure
it's their right... No, but it's their right to think that they've... I used to hate all the comics.
Yeah.
Who acted like they invented stand-up.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know,
you know what I mean? That came along about it was always better in my day, and you go, no, it isn't. It's always been moving on.
Yeah.
I was so impressed. Fucking, I loved... I was interviewed by Bob Monkhouse once, and he knew everyone coming through.
Yeah.
He loved comedy. Wasn't about the part he had to play in the history of it. He loved comedy. There'll be comics coming through now who will go, well, this is what he does, and he did the ads, and he did it, and you go, right, okay, haters. There's a little bit in the back of your mind going, meet us on stage, you know. But you're like a...
You're like
a dad arguing with a teenager in the streets, aren't you? Going, you're not having your ball back.
It's about being young, and you know, I think you're old. I get older, and the older I get with comedians, what I love about comedy is the way, and I think this maybe that is changing a little bit, but it's the way that all people from different backgrounds do it, and you come together, and you're all comedians, and however you choose to do it, if you successfully do it, I have some respect for you. However, you know, even if I wouldn't do that comedy. You know, the young, you know, I was a young comedy fan, and a lot of the young comedy fans are on YouTube putting comments, are going, oh, I don't like this comedian, so that means they're shit, you know, and blah, blah. But actually, once you've walked the road for a few years, you kind of go, well, there's a lot to respect about that comedian, but also I just like comedy, and, you know, you get older, and there's still comedians I don't like, but there is, but I will still respect them.
It's a faster game now from starting to get into TV, Jory. Yeah. There's a quicker turnover of picking people up and either dropping them or going, I think there's less investment.
Yeah, definitely.
In talent.
And there's a lot more people trying to do it. It's so hard to get through now, I think. So I don't think I could ever...
Well, people switch, you know what I mean? They're not at any channel long enough to get anything going because... I've been in meetings where they've sworn to you. You know, they go, I'm going nowhere. And the next day, they've announced that they've left, and you go, it's just one text going, twat. You know what I mean? Why even give us that ghost of hope?
Yeah.
Of But then that's the business, and you get used to that, and that's the whole thing of going. I think good stuff does make it through. It's frustrating that stuff that might be better than stuff that's out there doesn't make it through. But every now and then, you plug away for the love of it, don't you?
Yeah. You've got to really want to do it.
Something finds it and it finds a bigger audience, great. But you try to sort of focus on the fact that you're still doing something that it did start somewhere with a bit of love of watching something on TV. You know what I mean? That you were drawn to it.
Yeah.
And the fact that you're still working in it.
Yeah, but you're still...
It's a very fortuitous thing.
Yeah, but you're still... It seems to me you're still loving what you're doing and you're still interested in comedy and finding new things to do. You're thinking about, you know, what you can do next. I think you lose it when you stop caring and just think... You're just thinking about the money or you're just thinking about the fame or whatever. But if you're still interested in comedy, it is that Bob Monkhouse thing. And Bob Monkhouse was a comedian who got decried, you know, and my generation of comedy fans go, Bob Monkhouse, what an old, you know, gag-telling idiot. And then you get to know about him and you go, yeah, amazing. It's just that...
Yeah, and I'd have had an opinion growing up. You know, going, I remember arguing with somebody going... He's got that American thing of waits for the laugh after a gag, which I, you know what I mean? American comics do.
Yeah.
I used to find it really grinding.
Yeah. It was very slick and, you know, it was a bit
too
slick.
Yeah, and I think there was a slickness that made me...
Yeah.
And at what point do you decide you don't like slickness? It's a bizarre thing. You know the thing when you're drawn into it, you go, you want to watch somebody playing to 10 people that you think is brilliant. Than someone on TV. I don't know if it's a natural reaction to what your parents like or what the public like for a while. And then you learn the craft and then you come back. And like, if you're fortunate to meet him or chat to him, well, you suddenly go, that was his style. Your style's your style. And you also realise that there's a lot... It's brilliant joining Twitter because you don't know how to find out how many people fucking hate you. And genuinely want you, you know what I mean? Yeah. They want stuff to happen to your car and everything. Filled its MOT, twat. That's a weird door, you know what I mean? When you open it, and that was something I said never do. And you do, and yet you're going, again, it's Johnny. Johnny went, that's what it is, and walked off. And I deal with the aftermath. It's really hard as Michael being on a public network now where you go, I can't look at it if I've done a show for a bit. Because I hate to admit, I would find it demoralising. But then I've never let Johnny go on Twitter because that would ruin... That would be the end of... That would...
But no one's...
There'd be no more mortgage payments after that, wouldn't there?
No, I don't think, you know, I just get the point where you think with that, no comedian should be liked by everyone. A lot of these people are coming onto Twitter to have a go at you because they assume you think that everyone loves you. And maybe you did. Maybe you've been dissuaded of it. But, you know, it's not like you think everyone loves... But you're not,
look,
you know,
at
it's not, it's not like you thinking everyone loves me, so, you know, I need to be told not. So they have an idea of you, so those people coming to try and chip you down are attacking a version of you that they don't know. It's fine that people don't like you. It's kind of weird for those people to then track you down and let you know that they're like...
Yeah, but then I post stuff as Michael when I'm going... Boiler's not working. Friday night, bugger. And somebody comes on and goes, I'm sick of you millionaires making out they've got problems like the rest of us. And you're going, my fucking boiler's gone. Do you think I'm living Downton Abbey? What am I? I'll get the staff to run a metal, you know, boil the kettle and fill a metal bath for us. This is a real problem. It's not that I've stupidly shared it with you. And now there's somebody, possibly in a bed seat, who, you know what I mean? Damaged his own family whilst drink driving. He's looking for someone to blame. He's got them really awful showers where you can't fold the door shut because the cold water's pressing against his back. Of course he's going to go for me. I'm a fat bloke with a wet room. But I don't know. It's something getting used to. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's a new kind of criticism that you go, oh. And again, I think it's that constant. I just don't have the anger that I used to. And I don't want to manufacture it. It was real with Johnny.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be now. It would be, you know what I mean? It would be that. And my wife's so intuitive. And she said, early on, Johnny was up and coming and not part of the... Whether you like it or not, he's now part of the establishment. So to go out and play the bloke who's up against it is... it's asking those who love you and those who hate you equally for too much suspended disbelief.
Yeah. But you find
so go out and reinvent yourself.
You do reinvent yourself. I mean, that idea of him just being in a suitcase in the corner of the stage, that's it. Just he's there. And
heckling us.
It's sort of is a bit like, I thought you were going to sort of say it was a ventriloquist dummy. It's like having a ventriloquist dummy, which that part of you is like. I love the vent act, someone like Nina Conti, who they have that voice that's them. That's their Johnny, isn't it? That says the things that they want, that they don't want them to say, but the dummy says it. It's really interesting. So I think that's, and that most comedians have that within them somewhere. I think that they're saying the things that they shouldn't be saying.
Yeah, they're saying out here. Yeah. What when they're writing, they're looking in the mirror and going, "Yeah, well, you're just that's because you."
Well, I think we've, I'd love to talk to you for another hour and a half, but maybe we'll get you back on another time. Have you ever tried to suck your own cock?
Yes.
Yeah, good. So it's just for my notes.
But
I just
look, look at stomach. This. It's like Impossible Peace Talks, isn't it?
Ladies and gentlemen, please give a massive round of applause to Johnny Vegas. Ladies and gentlemen. Listening to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Johnny Vegas.
The music from this show is by the band Pest. They are quite good at playing instruments. Also, I want to thank everybody from the Leicester Square Theatre. I would also take this opportunity to say a thank you to Chris Evans, not that one, and all of his merry band of men and women, don't be sexist, from the GoFasterStrike.com team. My producer, Ben Walker, produced this with his producing hands. It is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStrike.com production. Please enjoy it. Thanks for listening to the show. You can come and see me attempt to do all 12 of my one-man shows at the Leicester Square Theatre in August and September, Fridays and Saturdays. You can buy tickets to just one of them, or more if you like. The more you buy for, the cheaper the tickets become. And if you come to all 12, you get a free T-shirt designed by me and drawn by me, because I am a fucking idiot. I could not have put together. Go to leicestersquaretheatre.com to find out about those, or for tickets to future rehearsals. I am indebted to the following people who helped us to pay for filming the podcasts. They are Matthew Smith, Ewan Duncan, Rob Applin, Darren Foote, Colin Anderson, Raymond Harpany, Kevin Tipcorn, Steve Mash, Dean Ratland, Gaynor Wilson, Adam Queck, Stuart Fawcett, Tim Turner, Julian Benton, Thomas Baldwin, Lauren Pilkington, Matthew Blackburn, Neil Martin, Jack Burton, Fraser Levy, Gina Lynn, Paul Jeffrey, Rob Ward, Robert Tang Richardson, Leo Vigoda, Carol Forster, Icky Kawa, Colm McGonagall, Aurora Watters, Jake, Heather Henderson, Simon Carl, Christine Sato, David Collier, Jijin John, Roy Owens, Matthew Poynton, and Shahabahu. I don't know how to pronounce that. It's Sha-O-Bo-Hu. That is what I think it is. Thomas Satchel. Come on. Milo. Tim Killen. Tim Mays. Jim Duckett. Paul Matthews. Dave Appleby. John Kearney. Dan Shakir. Thank you to all of you and all the other people who gave some money to the Kickstarter. We hopefully will do some more things like that in the future. You can support us next time if you didn't this time. Thanks very much. Goodbye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.